Accession number 30342, reel 17.
Another place, when I come to Wellingard and see the work, I had a place here, like where we live in this camp. And there was one old Scots bloke there. He would, he used to wear jumpers for pyjamas. And he would never go to the toilet, he'd just stand on the bed, open the window, peel through the window, and all that. And another bloke, and this bloke was there, Scouts broke, and he was a bit of an alcoholic, and he wouldn't go to the toilet. He was just peeing this can all the time, and the bloke said, hey, we can't have too much of this. So what they do, they got this big can thing, and they put it full of nail holes. So when he was standing there in the pee, he was peeing all over his own bed, and he was choked about that. There was another fellow, some Irish lads there, always smartly dressed. And so that guys went and got the razors and cut all his suits that he had, which was a bit mean. But and another thing, when I was building the army barracks at Tedworth, there was a guy there, and he wasn't very bright at all, in the Kilda one, but he was a ventriloquist. And they killed him on, and he bought a ventriloquist dummy, and he was no more ventriloquist than you and I were. And of course, he used to go to the pub in Bromley, and you go to this pub in Bromley, he said, have his dummy with him and all that, you know. And he used to talk to the dummy, and he'd see his mouth moves, he says, what my woman right now. And all the boys that she had all that. And he had the women and men folk in the bar and all that, you know, clapping on. And also said to him, he's the great Houdini, you can escape anyway. So I had wardrobes there with a bit of hardwood back. We used to put a bit of lighted paper at the back so the fire would go into the wardrobe where you kept your clothes and all that. He would push the fire, the hardwood out and jump out. He said, clapped saying the great Houdini escaped again. So this time, they said, had a table where he was writing a letter and had blankets over the table, and that was the trap for the dog. He was a greyhound. And they had there was lavender brushes that you have for cleaning the toilets with, had on a bit of a string, and that was the hare. And he was supposed to be a dog chasing the hare and all that, and poor man, he wasn't being very bright at all. Running on, pulling this lavender brush, picking the brush up and all that.
So this period is really, it's like an
ex-army bloke, more or less. You know,
but it's almost as if you're still in the army.
It was.
Because you're like a bunch of young men and you're still in a hostel and you've got to make your own entertainment. And so
it's the same thing.
So this is...
you're free.
Yeah. So when did you get married? How long later? Because you met a local girl, apparently.
I met a girl when I went to church one day, and she knew a mate of mine as well, Bill. And she was with him at the time, and I went out to church again with a couple of sons after, and she was in Bath, and I come out and I stood and talked to her. We just sort of got acquainted like that, and eventually got married and all that. You know.
And what year was that?
1951, I think it was, 51, and so, 13th of January it was.
So until then, were you still like living this hostel kind of life?
Yeah.
So you never, as a single man down south, you and everybody you know, nobody, I suppose the accommodation shortage, there was no way anybody could just like get their own flat.
Oh, no.
And what about when you were married by this stage? Was it easy to get a house or?
No, it was not. When we got married, we had a room in Sidcup, Black Fen. And it was one room, and by then I was working there in Tidworth Good Army Barracks, and I was coming home every weekend, and my wife was living in this one room, and started to have a child, and of course when I was coming home weekend, could have your bath in one. And of course, I had a daughter in the house, she was always taking the hot water, and I couldn't get a hot bath, you see. But it wasn't bad because I get plenty of bus miles away living in a hostel and all that. But the bed that we had was only about 18 inches off the floor. And my wife getting pregnant, she getting big, you know, she had an awful job to get off the bed and all that, you know. And I said, rub her tummy with the oil and all that, you know. And she got an oil session for drinking orange juice and things. I had to finish it more or less peeing pure orange juice as it were, drinking and drinking all that. And it probably had to do with the blood or something. And when the time came for to have the baby, I had to send her up north to my parents' house. And I remember seeing her on the King's Cross station, put on the train. She was crying when she left me. And I went to see this movie called Singing in the Rain with Gene Kelly and that sort of thing. And I've still got the video on here that I've taped. When I put that on, I think about that. But she went up there and she had a bit of a tough time with a baby because they delivered the baby and had to leave the baby and look after her for a while. And of course, about 3 or 4 weeks after that, I went back up there. And she had got in touch with some woman that I used to work with. And she said, we could have go and live with her. She had lost her husband in Sidcup. And Mrs. Buckham, she was a nice old lady, she was. Old lady, I suppose she was in her 40s or something then. I was just barely 30. And then I realised then I have to get a house. I've got to work for a house. So I looked around and this fella had come down from up north with me. He went to Crawley to have a look there. And I come to Welland Garden City. We're going to decide which place to live. So I looked at Welland Garden City. And someone spoke to me, were quite pleasant to me when I was there. And I thought, oh, I'll try here. And we come to Welland Garden City to live.
What year was that?
Live in a hostel here. I had to work in the hostel here for 18 months before I got a house.
And that would be a waiting list that there would be.
Yeah, waiting list because only because of building trade, you got a house, you see. We had to wait 18 months. And I got a house and it was great to get your own place and all that. Because I would like to have lived in Kent, because I like Kent. But of course, there was no chance of getting a house because when I checked on the housing list, it was 21 years. Before you got a house.
What did you think about that? I mean, you'd been through a war. I mean, obviously, it wasn't like the First World War. Nobody'd had this home fit for heroes. Nobody believed that. So when you looked at these 5 or 6 years of being in hospital, did you just accept that? That was the way it was? Or did you think this should be better than this? It should be easier. It should be... What did you and your colleagues in this hospital, did you think, well, what do we do? Was it? I mean, obviously, it wasn't the prison camp. It wasn't like, how long are we here? We're going to.
No.
But was there any resentment from anybody about the fact that you were still struggling to get by, really? Or?
Well, I don't talk to resentment because you just sort of accept that you didn't expect to get any better treatment. But I thought maybe you got your house a bit quicker than 18 months than that, but I didn't.
So what year did you get your house?
It must have been about 52 when we got.
And when do you think was that in terms of like the post-war years, when do you think, you know, you and your wife and your family, when do you think, well, we've finally, like, got here, we've got to where we want to be, as opposed to struggling? I mean, in terms of, like, you know, the war and rationing and all the rest, how long was it before you thought, well...
We never had any new furniture hard. It was all second-hand stuff and things like that to try, because we had no money at all, really. I had about 70 quid or something like that, which is a nothing thing. But
so how long, what you...
I bought a radio, and a radiogram thing, you know, played these records on. And we had a bed, a table, and a settee, which was a new one, a new settee. And I went to bought some carpets. And when I bought the carpets, I said, no, cannot give me enough line off what I put down in the toilet in the bathroom. He said, yeah, go and take that. So I just had to cut it all down and put it up. And I did some tidying in the bathroom yourself. Gradually got to quite a start, I'm square off now, but I'll start all over again and got the chance. It was really quite something, it was.
And in terms of wages, did they, when did they start to pick up?
Well, working for the Get Me House, they're very basic, the wages. But as soon as I got my house, I realised then I could get more money by travelling. So I was travelling to Stevenage. Instead of, say the wage was 4 bob, I could probably get 5 bob elsewhere, which you had to take as much as I possibly could. That, you know. So gradually got that, and went on a bonus, and you get a group of bricklayers that was prepared to work hard with as few labourers as they possibly could make with do with. And they got the same bonus. They didn't get the same rate of pay, but they got the same bonus. So they could work out that sometimes they got the 4 or 5 quid bonus. You know, maybe it was a 6 quid wage or something like that. And you got that way, you could get quite a fair bit of bonus. And of course, there comes a time when you can't do as much. I had a bad spell. I had a complaint about his stomach pains all the time and things like that. And I was going to work and I was eating all these rennies, which is a curious stomach pain, that, you know. Anyway, I had to come home one time from work and I saw the doctor. I rang my wife up and she says, I'll ring the doctor. The doctor says, come round to the surgery and examine you. The surgery was about 10 minutes walk. I walked in and he looked at me and says, I think you've probably got appendicitis. So he's getting the car and taking it down to hospital. The hospital's just down the way here. Well, of course, he had a mini. And of course, when you've got anything like that, you get the mini. The seat's not pulled back, and a hell of a job to get in and out. I went to the hospital and just stripped me off and lay down there. Says, does this hurt? Does this hurt? Does this hurt? No, no, no. She pressed this part, she kept it in there for quite some time. Then she let it go. And I kept switching it. Oh yes, so there and then I had to go and get the operation. And apparently I had what they call an acute appendix or something like that. Which was, if I hadn't had it done there and then, it might have been there more. I might not have been around that, you know. But I got back all right. And my wife says, you're not going back in the building trade because I had to go and get my tools from work. When I went to get the tools, it was on the building side, up to the ears and button again. I was at Stevenage. So I come back from Stevenage and I went back to work in Bonner Garden City on the houses there. And I thought, oh, and I looked at the local paper, there was a builder I wanted to work at Hatfield Polytechnic. So I went there, had an interview there, and there was 8 of us for the job. And he asked me different things, whatever, you know, and I told me qualifications. So he says, well, go ahead, I'll see some more when you come back. Oh, he says, you're the one. Oh, so he says, you can start. So I gave him a week's notice, I think. And I went there. And of course, from being the doggy dog straight outside, it was completely easy there. And me being the only bricklayer there, I could cash in because they didn't know what to do, what not to do. So I had
how fast to do it.
Yeah. So I was working 6 days a week. I was only working 5, I'd book the Saturday in because I could do enough work on the Friday if I had to cover the Saturday and nobody knew.
Just on a general point, this is the 50s and so on, into the 60s. You mentioned before the war, you got to work, everybody had a bike.
Yeah.
In the late 40s and the 50s, you're in these hospitals and then you were married in the house. How were you getting to work?
Oh, I was getting on a bike.
Still on
a bike? When I went to Stevenage, they used to rent a bike down the Great North Road there. And I'd have a coach lead on. And they'd take me to Stevenage in the coach and bring you back, drop you there to get on your bike. And,
so when were the bikes replaced by cars? When did people become affluent enough where they could afford?
I think what years I was? Had my car about 1958 to 1959.
And is that one generally What about motorbikes and sidecars and that? Were any of those? Because that was like.
Oh yeah, no. Well, I couldn't. I've not been on the boat. I was on a motorbike with a friend of mine up north. Took me on one time. I just had to lead the left, no, not lead the right. Now trying to lead the other way. Remember that sort of thing.
But even so, in the late '40s and early '50s, it was still bikes.
Oh,
most workmen.
Yeah. Oh yes, yes.
So who would have? Would anybody on the site have a car? Any of you workmen?
Very few, very few. The odd one was sort of, oh, that was something special, though. That, you know?
So it was like a luxury.
Yeah, it certainly was a luxury.
Yeah. And
I bought a Hillman Mix, which was a family car.
Is that when you thought that things had finally looked up, when you could say, oh, I can afford a car now and I've got a house? And
yeah, oh yeah, it was sort of a...
So it was literally like 13 years after the war before...
Oh yes, indeed.
Got to where you wanted to be.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
I remember going up north in the car. My wife passed the test before I did. So we said, we'll go up north to my parents' house. And I said to the wife, I said, no, I said, yeah, you've just finished learning how to drive. I said, you haven't been on the motorway. I said, you'll have to go on the motorway to get a bit of experience before you actually drive up north. So I said, okay. So we get in the car, we drive to the studio. So I said, no, you're on the motorway, you've got to put your foot down. I says, don't like driving to town. So she put her foot down, going heading along there. And that. She said, okay, turn off now. Well, she should have eased up. We were turning off and said that. She was still doing plenty of 70 coming on. Hey, 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 stop that, you know. And we've had a bit of a joke about that. But, after that, she drove up and still had the L plates on, which she was driving, and then we stopped. And now I got inside the drive, it pushed me up a little bit, but I just got back and eventually passed my test. But it took a long time for me to pass my test.
What year was that?
Well, I was stall or something, I don't know, make a wrong move and something.
But what year would be?
1958, I passed, probably.
Now, so you were down in Welwyn Garden City, you had your house, you were working, you were married, you put the army behind you, you mentioned a little bit about you met the odd person.
Yeah, well, when I come to Welwyn Garden City, the bloke who had been, I think I mentioned previous chats I had about this fella called Robbo, and when we used to go out pinching, we used to pinch on the biggest skills we possibly could. And Rob would come in with something that was so minor and things like that. You know, and he, look what I've got here, and he's, you know. So, and I met him, and he used to work Smith's News Agents, but his dad did apparently, at Manchester. And he lived at Bayhall Green here, which is just across the road here.
Was he in the prison camp? Or
he was in the prison camp with me. He was the one I was looking after him at the finish, you know, because the... He was working here, and I didn't have much time with him because he was married, and I was in the building trade, worked as many hours as I possibly could, and he moved out to the area. And another chap I met in Welwyn Garden City, who had been in the prison camp, but we just drifted apart for some reason. I must have been in Italy, I think, when I saw him. And I saw those two guys in Wales, like I said.
What about the DLI? Because apparently there were quite a lot of, Jimmy Cairns that you mentioned, ex-Beds and Hearts, there were Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire Regiment men who were from this area.
Yeah.
Who were your NCOs, and they were...
Yeah, that's right.
Do you know any of those people?
I remember when I come to Welwyn Garden City, I've been there about 18 months, and somebody came and spoke to me, and he said he had been in there. You know, it was me, whether the prison camp or the DLI. I've been in the DLI, I think.
What about the Regimental Association? Did you have any truck with those?
No, I didn't have anything at all to do with that.
Or the Old Comrades Association? You were not aware of the...
I should have done, but
you didn't even know they existed.
Because I remember joining the British Legion when I was in South Shields, because there's a shortage of beer, and you could always go and get a pint there. Because the beer shortage was on, they'd just go up in the pub and buy a beer and they'd put the towel over the pumps. And there was a shortage of beer and they couldn't get it. So me and Hodge joined us from the British Legion.
And I mean, the reason that we're talking now is because of my website and the Shields Gazette article. Now, what was your reaction when your friend sent you this newspaper with your
Well,
photograph in it? What did you think of
he
that?
rang me and he says, "I've sent you a photograph of yourself." I thought myself, "What did he want to send a photograph of me for?" Of course, he had left a message on the telephone. I hadn't heard him speak. I thought, it's a photograph of him, I wonder not me. And of course, when I got it, it was a fair sort of envelope. It was part of the Shield Gazette. I knew it was maybe Italian. And there's a picture. If your dad in that picture as
Picture of
well,
my father and a picture
yeah,
of
and
Foster.
poster, yeah. So I thought, well, what can I do about this, And
But were you surprised to see, were you aware of the photograph?
I already had one somewhere. I've got one indoors
So
somewhere.
you didn't know that the photograph had been taken.
No, I didn't know it had been the Shield Gazette.
No, but you were aware of the photograph. You know, you
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 mean the whole battalion?
yeah, the big
Oh
one.
yes, indeed, I
Yeah.
had one somewhere. I'd seen it before, put it that way. And I guess it, so that's when I tried to get in touch with George. So I rang up inquiries, and that's what upset me a bit to a certain degree. I tried to find out where he lived, and I was talking to somebody in India. These voices they have, these Indians have. What have I got to go to there for? Anyway, she said, I'll find a number for you. She found a number. She said, "Well, I'll try it for you." I says, "Yes," but she tried. She couldn't get a reply. So I says, "Okay." And by that time, I had got the number, I think. No, I hadn't got the number. So I rang again later on in that evening, and I spoke to an English girl. Whether it was an English girl living in England, no, I don't know, but I got the impression it was. And she was quite good at me. She gave me the number right away, and I says, "I'll get it myself," and rang her, got in touch with George, and then a few, couple of minutes chat, they were on the same wavelength and all that,
Did that all come back then when you talked to him? All your
Well, you
experiences?
see, being the there, he was being the same. Actually, he lived no more than 3 or 4 yards away from where I lived. So I didn't know him. But the same story again, it must have been the same place, same, go to the same cinema and things like that.
And there were quite a few men from Shields in the battalion, weren't there?
Oh, there was,
Probably
yeah.
a lot more than you actually knew. I mean, there were the people that you did know,
Yeah.
but there'll have been others as well.
There's one, I told you about that one, that, I think his name was Burns or something, I can't recall. And he was the one that, when this, Thomason, RSM Thomason, Tommy, passed it when I was going to go to Hastings for a weekend. And really annoying that was. So I went anyway. And there was this Thomas wanted to fight us and all that and get in the box and you go and knock hell out of us and all that. And this Burns was a big lad as well. But we've realised, no. It's just like trying to fight Joe Lewis or somebody like that, no.
Is that the Burns that's on the Roll of Honour, or is it a different one?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I
yeah,
don't know.
yeah. I think we talked earlier a little bit about, again, this is like a story that came back to you that you didn't have any direct experience of, but you mentioned Thomason and the carrier, and you know something about them throwing the men off the carrier or something.
Oh
And
yeah, that.
who told you that story? Because obviously this would have had to have been
Oh
after the
yeah.
war, or you know, or during in
Oh,
the camp or something.
I don't know who told me, but yeah, he apparently. I got a, through the grapevine, whatever it was, and our fellows were shelling this wood. My battalion was shelling in the wood, and I realised when the bad spot, they should get out of there, and they got their gear to go out, and they must have put in this bread carrier, whatever it was, I don't know. But he come along and came a right old rollicking, threw everything out of the bread carrier, put all his in, and shot off the bread carrier and left all the boys behind. That's the story I got.
And this must have been from somebody that either got captured a little bit
Must have been.
later,
Must have been, yeah.
yeah, or that you met.
Whatever it was, yeah.
Yeah. So this was going on all the way through the war, that you'd hear secondhand stories about people that
Yeah,
you used to know, and people that friends and so on.
that's right. Of course, when
Yeah.
you got a couple of telephone and things like that. But it was a really nasty person he was.
Can you remember anything about your colour sergeant going back to 42? I think it's a fellow called Barker, I think, on the phone.
Yeah, no, I've seen that picture, and Barker comes back to me. And I seem to remember one time picking a towel up I'd found down the boat or something. And I went to get a change and all that. He says, take that bloody thing with you. I exchanged the other half of that this morning. Something like that, you know. I was trying to get this book sheet, whatever it was trying to tell us.
I mean, this is going back quite a bit further, back to Brandsbeth. Just a question about that. Do you remember anything about the CEO, a fellow called Hastert? He was...
Hastert. He committed suicide. That's his... Yeah.
What do you remember about that?
All I know was it wasn't there very long before he committed suicide. And remember a lad called Tommy Harrison, he come from Stockton or somewhere like that. And he says, my name is Colonel Amisha Hastert, and I don't know nicknames, Hastert and something else, which you derive. You know, everyone thought it was a good joke not having that. Now. But I don't know why he committed suicide, I don't know.
But he did introduce himself to the men.
Well, he must have done, yeah.
Yeah.
He must have done.
What impression did he make on people? Because apparently he was very well respected.
No, I can't...
Yeah, so you didn't have much contact with him?
No, not really, no.
Yeah. This is just going to something that my father mentioned years ago, and this is going back to Italy, and the Australians and South Africans in the camps. Do you remember much about them? Because my father had this story that they were very, very pushy with the guards. You know, they were always getting themselves into trouble by, you know, they were talking back.
One of the lads, I don't know where it was, in Aussie or not, but what he did, the Italian guys were a bit scared and that, you know. And one of the fellas opened his battle dress blouse and charged towards the bloke with his bayonet, when he got his bayonet out, and tied him right away like hell and all that. You know.
The one with the bayonet ran away?
Yeah, that's right, yeah, I remember that. And he used to walk about at night, consoling each other about shouting, Sentinelli, talking to each other, of course, in case anybody tried to escape and all that.
Just going back to Whitley, which of the two camps did you prefer? The Italian camps, the 56, 53 and 66?
I think probably 53. I don't know. Yeah.
The second one?
The second one, yeah. That was Maserati. That was when I told about the two campers. The boys, his own brother was a prisoner. Him and I, Campbell and I from Jara, was walking about, and somebody shouted to him, and he looked up, and lo and behold, it was his brother. And he said, I'm glad to see him. He said, I don't mean glad to see you, he says, but you know, he says, I'm glad to see you. I've got a parcel sent me, sir. You know, I'll share that. The first time I know I've seen that, probably because I sent it to you. So that's a story. That's quite a true story.
Yeah. Just moving, just tying up a few points. When you were at the end of the war as a POW, did you have any contact at all with the Russians? Did you see the Russians?
I worked with the Russians.
Oh yeah, in the prison camp.
In the prison camp.
But the Russian army.
No.
So you got away from them.
I'm getting them. Yeah, the Russians were coming in. The left, we were at the right. So we moved.
What did? I mean, obviously the Germans were scared of the Russians. What about yourselves, you fellow British POWs? Were you scared of the Russians, or were you?
Well, the Russians I knew were got on quite well.
Oh yeah, but they were
fellow prisoners.
Yeah,
but I quite never come across any Russian soldiers, as it were.
Now, just on that point, when you're working in the railway yard, and then you were marched away. Were the Russian prisoners marched away with you, or did they?
I don't know, because they never.
They weren't with you at this
compound.
Yeah, they weren't with you at that stage.
No.
Yeah.
But they've got a rough deal compared to what we did.
You mentioned with the Americans when you know this business with the soldier with a gun and so on.
That's right. Yeah.
Any other members of the Americans? Your impressions of them?
When the American was taken prisoner, I do remember our bloke that was in charge was at this work camp, saying, "Anybody got a spare shirt or a vest or something, got to give to these American lads, you know." So you might have some shirts, surplus, not actually surplus, but So he gave it to the Americans, and they were putting two shirts on at one time, saying that wears.